You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm so happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Anne Hillerman. She is author of the new book, The Tale Teller, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 23rd of May at 6 o'clock in the evening. It's part of the Mystery Writers Salon, and she will be appearing with Courtney White, who's also written a new mystery called The Sun. Welcome, Anne, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
So you're the author of many books, including five books in the, what would you call it, the Tony Hillerman, post-Tony Hillerman series?
Yeah. I call it the publisher is calling it the Joe Leporn, Jim Chi, Bernie Manuelito series.
Perfect.
So it's a long name for the stories.
Well, and they're books that you started writing after the death of your father, Tony Hillerman. And you took some of his characters, the ones you just mentioned, ran with them. They have a bunch of adventures. And it's so interesting, you know, having read your dad's books and now having read your books, they're the same characters, but they're not quite the same. And there's definitely more of a female sensibility and stronger women characters. And I just wondered, first of all, how you feel about that. Like, is your Jim Chi the same Jim Chi as your dad's?
Well, yeah, he is, but he's a little older, a little mellower, maybe a little smarter. In a lot of my dad's books, Jim Chi was really driven by the quest to find the perfect woman. And dad created several terrible girlfriends for him. And then finally, Bernadette Manuelito comes into the picture. So when I took over the series, Jim Chi and Bernie Manuelito were already married. So I didn't have to deal with all of that kind of bachelor energy with Jim Chi. I was able to let him sort of settle down and just kind of focus on being a crime solver and focus on finally being happy with the woman who is really meant for him. So one of my challenges, I had Jim, I had Joe Leporn, who was a strong character, and then I had Bernie Manuelito, who I really wanted to raise to be a full-fledged crime solver. So I thought, how can I, as a beginning fiction writer, deal with three main characters? So in a way, I kind of put Jim. Jim had basically been, for quite a while, been a sidekick to Joe Leporn. So in my first book, I make him a sidekick to Bernie, and he didn't mind. He was happy to do that.
And she's really elevated from being the good wife or whatever to being really a crime solver and a three-dimensional character in her own right.
That's right. In Dad's books, in a couple of his books, she did pretty well, but she always made bad enough mistakes that Jim Chi came to rescue her. So when I took over the series, I thought, no, I don't want Bernie to be rescued anymore. So in fact, in my first book, she gets to rescue Jim Chi. I thought that was kind of a good twist.
Now, you also bring back in this book the legendary solver of mysteries, Lieutenant Joe Leporn. He's retired. He's not out of business. He's doing sort of private investigator work. He's had a head injury, which doesn't stop him, but it does slow him down in the sense that he's not so able to speak English, but he speaks Navajo perfectly. Is that like a classic brain injury of some kind?
Yeah, it is. My husband has had a bunch of strokes, so he's been dealing with speech therapists. So when I was thinking about what would happen with Joe as he, you know, is having trouble speaking, and would the language that he'd learned first, would that language come back to him first? And the therapist I talked to said, yeah, they often see that a person, say, who grew up speaking German, if they have a stroke, they will maybe remember the German from their childhood. It won't be an adult vocabulary, but those words will come back first. And then gradually they'll regain their English. So that's kind of what's happened to Joe.
Very interesting. Meanwhile, Bernie Manuelito and Jim Chi are a great crime-fighting duo, but it's also about the family, kind of the extended family. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was, I think it was Bernie's mother wants her to come home and do weaving. And I thought that's such an interesting symbol of the kind of traditional versus modern life in the Navajo Nation or you know, in the Pueblo world. And I was wondering, like, do you feel like a lot of the characters in your books and in real life are walking that line?
I do. I really do. I see that whenever I go out to the Navajo Nation. People who have, from our Anglo-Western perspective, very successful lives. But then they'll say, well, I'm taking off a week because I have to go to a ceremony and I have to help my mom with the cooking, with the wood, with all of that stuff. So I think it's easier if you are an entrepreneur or self-employed rather than trying to juggle, say, a traditional estate job. The Navajo Nation is very receptive to giving people leave like that. But you know, if you work for the state of New Mexico or the state of Arizona, you might have a hard time saying, I need a week off because I have to go to a healing ceremony for my uncle.
Right. And that is completely normal life in virtually the entire history of human beings on this earth.
Right. I think that was one thing that really has made us last so long, that for a long time our families were the main value, and then making a living kind of came in second. And right. So lately I wouldn't say lately, but for a few generations it's kind of been turned on its head.
And I mean, not only family, but specifically ceremony.
Right.
And that kind of, I mean, weaving is just a symbol of ceremony that holds the world together.
That's exactly right, yeah. And the idea that that your spiritual life is just as important as your professional life. And you don't see that value much in mainstream society.
So how do you do the research for these books? Do you spend a lot of time in the Navajo Nation? Do you travel around the state a lot? New Mexico, Arizona?
Yeah, I find I usually start with setting when I'm working on my books, and one real gift my dad gave me was setting his stories in real places, so I'm able to go to Window Rock, to Crown Point, to Shiprock, to Toadlena, all these places, and just kind of get a sense of what it's like there. And of course, as an outsider, I can't ever get the same sense as a person who's been there for however many generations there have been people there. But still, it really helps me kind of ground the books in reality. And while I'm there, I just try to kind of chat with people, you know, see, you know, what's, you know, what do you do for fun? Which, you know, it's, and thank goodness, because my dad spent so many years building relationships, when I talk to people, when they hear my name, particularly if they're people, say, 40 and up, they recognize the name, and then they usually will, you know, will be happy to see me and will tell me some stories. And then I do a lot of other online research and library research. So much has been written about the Navajo that it's not hard to find little tidbits. So when I find a little tidbit and I think, well, this is interesting, then I'll bounce it off one of the Navajo people I talk to and say, so I found this in a book. Does this seem like something that would really happen? And you know, either they'll say yeah, or they'll say, I never heard of that. Or some families might do that, but it's not very common. So,
and there's always the question of, you know, how accurate are outsiders when they're doing anthropology, even if it's people living close to here, they're doing anthropology about their neighbors. But for many non-Navajo or non-Native people who didn't grow up in that world, they miss big things.
Sure. Sure, sure. So I try to remind myself when I get too carried away with research that besides writing Mystery Set on the Navajo Nation, I'm also writing mysteries. And so I need to kind of keep my eye on moving the story forward and not getting too involved in, say, how do you spin and card the wool if you're going to make a rug to help somebody celebrate their wedding anniversary, you know, to just sort of keep focused on the story rather than all of these lovely little details that I think kind of enrich the story.
Right, right. Now, when you go and travel around, you know, your father's books are very well known. Is he well respected, for example, in the Navajo Nation?
Yeah. Yeah. They taught his books in junior high and high school, in schools throughout the reservation for a long time. So I'll run into, you know, somebody who's 40, and he might say, oh, yeah, I remember I read your dad's book in high school.
Very interesting.
It is. It's really fun.
So the plot of this book, The Tale Teller, centers around a number of mysteries, one of which involves a weaving. It's an antique dress that was sent to a Navajo Culture Museum, but it never arrives, but we're not sure at what point in the chain of having been packed up to arriving it has gone missing, and you have to read the book to find the answer to that. But the significance of the dress and the history that it points to is an interesting story in itself.
You know, it is, and I think it's a story that probably is not well known outside the Southwest, and maybe not even outside the Four Corners area. It's sort of the Navajo equivalent of the Trail of Tears, where the U.S. government had the idea that the Navajo were causing too much trouble and they should be removed from their traditional homeland down to basically a concentration camp in southern New Mexico, and turned into farmers, and then maybe they would give them some farmland in Oklahoma. Well, after a while, the army realized that the Navajo, the land was terrible for farming. The Navajos were starving, were catching all kinds of bad diseases, and were just heartbroken. They couldn't thrive down there. So finally there was a treaty which created the Navajo Nation, which let the Navajo move back to their homeland. And I mean, it's a huge part of American history and a huge part of Navajo history. So I thought, if I'm going to bring back this legendary character, Joe Leaphorn, who I had sidelined for my first four books, I need a big story for him to work on. And so I thought, this is really important in the history of Navajos, this whole event. And writing about this will give me a chance, besides telling a good story, to teach people who don't know much about Navajos or about the Southwest to just give them a tiny little history lesson. And I had seen an exhibit at the Navajo Nation Museum in Window Rock, which was of a dress that had been woven by Juanita, who was the wife of Manuelito, who was one of the people who signed the treaty that established the Navajo Nation. The government did not realize that women had a lot of power among the Navajo, so they didn't have any women sign the treaty. But Juanita is enormously respected. She's like the founding mother, you could say, of the Navajo Nation. So this exhibit was a dress that she had worn, that she had been photographed in around the time the treaty was signed. And maybe 20,000 Navajo people came to see this dress. It was huge. It was like a relic of the Holy Cross if you were displaying it in Santa Fe. So that was one thing that gave me the idea that maybe there could be a weaving like this that would be donated to the Navajo Museum anonymously, and then something happens. And so Joe Leaphorn needs to figure this out.
It's an interesting and important lesson in history because, I mean, so many Native people were moved from one place to another as if they were just transferable, you know, animals or something. And the reality is that virtually everybody is really tied to their land and their rituals and understanding and words and language and customs and way of getting food and everything else is based on a particular place. And because the Navajo finally, I don't know if you want to say were allowed to or fought for, but whatever, they were restored to their place and became a very successful and powerful nation among Native people here on this continent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one facet of the Navajo way is that you don't focus on the negative. You move forward, you set your sights on positive goals. And so, if for a long time it was difficult for the Navajo Nation to talk about what happened at Bosque Redondo because so many people died, it was a very sad, awful time. But recently, the Navajo government has been reframing that not just the government, but leaders all throughout the Navajo Nation, have been reframing that event to focus more on the resilience of the people who survived that and then came back to their homeland, and from maybe 10,000 Navajos, rebuilt the Navajo Nation to be now 350,000 people and really one of the most, if not the most successful Native group in the United States. So I think, you know, with that spin, I felt comfortable, again, as an outsider, writing about something that had been tragic, but that also was really a milestone in the creation of the modern Navajo Nation. And I think, I mean, everyone who is alive today on the Navajo Nation should be really proud of their ancestors who survived that terrible time and came home and basically rebuilt their lives from nothing.
The long walk, the kind of Navajo equivalent of the Trail of Tears, the word for it in the book is Hueldi, is that how you say it? Something like that?
That's how I say it. That's
and it means a place of suffering, referring to Bosque Redondo. And the reason I'm saying it is because I listened to the audiobook, which I have to say, I mean, many of our listeners are readers, many of them are listeners to books for whatever reason, but they've become very popular. And the woman who reads this book is herself Native, and so her way of speaking all these words and just the kind of feel of the narrative and the different accents are really beautifully done. It really adds something to the book.
I think so too. I try to use Navajo words. I mean, sometimes I know very, very little Navajo, but I know enough to know that those are words that are very specific and that don't really translate well into English. So I try to use them. And I hope any Navajo people who think, oh, we wouldn't say it exactly that way, will just forgive me.
Yes, indeed. Now, you said that in the first four books in this series, you kind of sidelined Joe Leaphorn. Why did you sideline him? Why did you bring him back now?
Well, as I mentioned, when I was first starting to write, I didn't think I could handle three main characters. But I knew that Leaphorn had to be in the book. So I came up with something very bad that happened to him, which then is a big crime that Bernie had to solve. Because my other thought was, if I'm introducing this character who's always been the sweet little thing who brought the coffee, and now she's going to be a detective, she needs a big crime to establish herself. So something bad happens to Joe in that first book. And then in the second book, he's getting a little better. In the third book, he's getting a little better. In the fourth book, he's getting a little better. So finally, and part of my hesitation was that he was the character my dad began the series with back in 1970. And there's a lot of my dad in him. And, you know, grief takes a long time. And I just didn't feel quite comfortable really spending the time you have to spend to have to take a character from the beginning of a story to the end of the story with all of the permutations and rewrites and things that happen in that process. But after doing those other books, I thought it's time for this character to come back. I thought, you know, he's had enough vacation. He's well enough now, and I'm strong enough now. We can be a team. And once, I guess after about the first month of working with him, I found that I really loved working with him. I found just so much energy there and so many little details of his personality that I hadn't really realized were there. So, yeah, I was glad that I took a chance on him, and I'm going to use him more now in my coming books because I feel like he and I have made peace, and he's a good guy.
It's so interesting to me how fiction writers talk about their characters as if they had an independent existence. You know, I'm discovering things about him as if he were out there, and I suppose in some ways that can't really be described in a scientific manner. They kind of are.
You know, before I started writing fiction, I would hear people say that. And I would think, oh, that's just too pretentious and far out there. And yeah, I don't know how to explain it. I think partly because you end up spending more time with them maybe than you do with your real family. And so they do sort of take on an energy and a life of their own. I have dreams about them. It's like, I mean, they're particularly if I'm in kind of a, I was, when I was working on my first novel, I was in kind of a stuck place. And I spent a lot of time as a journalist going to a lot of big meetings. So I'm at this big meeting. It's in a school gym and there's folding chairs. And of course, because it was a dream, I'm not sure, you know, who do I talk to? Do I have my tape recorder? Blah, blah, blah. And Bernie is there, my main character from the first book. And she comes up to me and she says, you know, you just worry too much. You should just let things flow. I think, oh, okay, I get it.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that's nice about this book is that Joe Leaphorn has, I don't know if you want to call it a girlfriend, but he has a lady friend, and he's doing this sort of stereotypically male thing about not really, you know, expressing how he feels and all of that. It's really quite amusing to watch because she's a professor, and he's, I mean, it's a very different, I mean, he's really, in a lot of ways, the strong silent type, and she's extremely verbal and articulate.
Yep. Yep. And also she has been, because of his injury, she has been basically taking care of him. She's been making a lot of decisions. She's been doing the driving. She's been doing the talking. And now in The Tale Teller, Joe is better. And Joe doesn't want her to do that anymore. And she is having difficulty adjusting to not being in that role.
Right.
And I mean, I've seen that in relationships, and I hadn't really planned on having that in this book, but it just sort of arose from the circumstances. And several people said to me that they appreciated it, that they thought it worked pretty well.
Yeah, very much so. And it leaves you wanting to know what happens in the next book if you're going to continue that theme. I mean, there's something really nice about writing a series because, although, you know, this is a standalone book for sure, you don't have to have read the entirety of Tony Hillerman's books or even your first books in this series. It's nice, but it's not necessary. But then again, it's like, okay, so are they going to sleep together? You know, I mean, I don't know. Or are they going to kiss? Whatever. But we don't know.
That's right. That's why they call it a mystery.
It's a mystery. So another character, if you can call it that, in the book is Navajo jewelry. And there's some pieces which are, you know, again, in this mysterious anonymous shipment of donations to the museum, the dress disappears, and also another piece of Navajo jewelry disappears. There's also jewelry that shows up in a flea market that had been stolen. There's jewelry in a trading post. There's jewelry on people's bodies, on their arms, and so on. We can't, as the reader, see it. It's a book. But did you have certain pieces, certain artists in mind as you were writing?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I have basically a Tale Teller wedding ring, and I have loved it forever. And so one time I was thinking, gee, what are the bracelet in the book is what's called a Tale Teller bracelet. So I thought, gee, it would be nice to have a bracelet that went with this ring. So I spent a while when I would go to, say, the Santa Fe Indian Market, or Navajo jewelry is very common on the reservation in flea markets. If you pull up to a parking lot, somebody may come up and want to sell you something. So I'd seen a lot of jewelry, and every time I saw one of those bracelets, it was a little different. So while I didn't have a specific artist in mind, I certainly had that style of bracelet because I really, really love those. And then there's a bolo tie. And I mean, again, bolo tie. I think bolo ties are just so cool. You know, they're comfortable. They're beautiful.
It's
you
the don't state have, tie.
The state tie. You don't have to take them to the cleaners if you spill soup on them. And so I thought, well, I should have a bolo tie in this. So I did a slideshow to go with this book when I do presentations. And I thought I should have a picture of a bolo tie, because when I go to Maryland or New Hampshire, maybe they won't know what a bolo tie was. So anyway, so now I have a picture of a bolo tie in my slideshow too. But yeah, I think I didn't specifically have any artists in mind, but there are many Navajo jewelers named Peshlakai, because the name translates as silver. Smith.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, and most of them are wonderful. So, yeah. And, oh, there's another wonderful Navajo artist named Orlin Joe. When I was in my newspaper days, I did an interview with him. He was part of Indian Market, and I loved his work.
You were talking about a style of jewelry, you know, Tale Teller bracelet, Tale Teller ring, and that's the name of the book, The Tale Teller. What specifically is that? What kind of tales are being told in this jewelry?
It'll be, say, as an example, maybe the first little part of the bracelet will be a hogan, and then you'll see a section that has clouds, and then you'll see a section with horses, and then maybe you'll see a corral, and then in the last section, you'll see the horses in the corral and the hogan, and the clouds will be low, like a big storm is coming.
Very interesting.
Yeah, kind of like I guess like pictographs.
Right.
But more detailed.
And so that serves as both the kind of jewelry and a kind of larger metaphor for the book.
Right, right, right. And there also is a kind of Navajo weaving called a tale teller, which maybe will have, in addition to the yarn, might have, say, a little bird feather or something that's reminiscent of where the weaver was when she wove that rug. And so my dad invented a tale teller rug in his last book, and this was a rug that had to do with Bosque Redondo, where the people down there, I mean, there were a few sheep. They would basically unravel whatever kind of textiles they had and weave. So Dad invented this rug that was a reminder of the terrible time, and then it gets stolen. Anyway, he called it a tale teller rug. So I thought, well, I'm just going to use that name. So I did.
Excellent. Now, another thing that you have to do that mystery writers have to do in general is understand the inner workings of law enforcement. And many of these writers do not come from law enforcement themselves. A few do. But here you are, I mean, you've got the tribal police, and then they have relationships to non-tribal, like state police, whatever, FBI. And you need not only to know information of how they work, but also their cultures and the sort of rivalries and competitiveness between them and among them. How do you find that out? How much of it is your imagination?
Oh, you know, that part, it's so interesting how many cultures there are in these books. I, just through pure luck, I was doing a talk at the, I think they call it the Jewish Cultural Center in Albuquerque. They have an annual book fair, and this was about 4 years ago. And this gentleman came up to me, and he said, "Oh, I loved your dad's books, and I've been wanting to meet you." He said, "I taught at Crown Point High School, Navajo kids, for about 5 years." He said, "And then after I did that, I went to law school, and then I joined the FBI. And I was stationed in South Dakota. Then I was stationed on the reservation. And then I was the one who was one of the first responders at the Oklahoma City bombing." So I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. So he and I talked a lot. We became friends. And he has been a wonderful resource because he understands, I mean, he spent a lot of time with the Navajo, so he kind of understands that part, as well as the Navajo police, because he worked with them both when he was a teacher and things would happen in his school, and also as part of the FBI. And then I have some retired Navajo cops who help me with that. And then I have some friends in the Santa Fe Police Department, women police officers. All my other helpers are guys, but I have some women in the Santa Fe Police Department who are really very wonderful and forthcoming about what their motivation was to become police officers, kind of what it's like to always be a little bit on the outside, how you always, even in 2019, have to still prove yourself a little more than the guys do, how as a woman you're also balancing a relationship and maybe kids with your job, and etc.
Whereas men are never balancing a relationship and kids with their job.
Well, I mean, that's a stereotype, but it does seem like
It is one side. I mean, it is imbalanced for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
To this day.
I mean, it seems like often male officers are married to women who are full-time moms, whereas a woman officer, the ones I know are basically single moms, or they're with a woman partner who also is working full-time.
Right.
So it's just a different situation.
Now, part of the craft of mystery writing also, and this is maybe a question that the writers who are listening might be especially interested in, but the way it works, as I understand just from being a reader, is you're creating multiple plot lines. I mean, there's different thefts or murders or whatever, you know, assaults, and they converge in one way or another as the mystery is solved. at the same time, you have to be doing all of this without tipping off the reader so that we know on page 7 how it's all going to turn out, which you don't want to do, and which I did not do. I mean, I was the whole time I was scratching my head going, okay, wait, like who, what? How do you do this? Like, do you have a plot map on your desk? Do you have little pieces of, like, do you, things that you move around?
I don't know. I have, my brain just kind of goes in a circle. And I have an idea, and then I have another idea. And I just try to keep the momentum going of the story. And I'm working on a book now that involves the Alamo Navajo Reservation down by Socorro and the Very Large Array. So I'm working on this, and I'm thinking, well, as I'm going, I'm thinking, gee, I need another suspicious person. So who could this be? So I have kind of brought this person in now about chapter 9. And when I brought her in, I thought, okay, now I'm going to need to go back and plant the clues for her, you know, earlier in the book. But I mean, there are people who do plot maps. Sometimes when I'm writing, I will think this is a really good thing and I should do more with it. But say it's something that I'll need to do research on. So I'll just sort of highlight it and go back to it. So I think for me, a lot of the kind of the finesse of building, they call them red herrings, fake clues, suspicious people who turn out to be good guys and good guys who turn out to be suspicious people, all of that stuff sort of happens in the rewrite. In that when I'm doing the first draft, I just try to kind of start with the crime and have it solved at the end and figure out who did it and why they did it, and then put the kind of the details that give it the texture in as I'm working on it for the second and third draft.
I can't remember which author who said, or maybe many of them or all of them, that the essence of writing is in the rewriting.
There are people, yeah. And then there are people, like you were saying, who do those plot maps, who do those outlines, and by the time they've done all that front work, they can pretty much sit down and just write it.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the human brain is just so fascinating and different. And I think that's what makes reading such a joy. Every book is just a different reflection of whatever personality and whatever genius or creative spark put it together.
And I just have to say, being a dog person, there's also a very good dog in the book.
Oh, there he is.
And spoiler alert, he comes to a happy end.
Somebody told me once, no matter what you do, the dog has to live.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Well, Anne Hillerman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Now, you will be on Thursday, the 23rd of May, you will be at Collected Works Bookstore. It's the Mystery Writers Salon, and you will be there with Courtney White, who's written a new book, also a mystery, called The Sun.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. I just read Courtney's book, and it's really good. It's set in New Mexico. He has a lot of interesting characters, a lot of good plot twists. Yeah, I like his book a lot, so I'm looking forward to talking to him about how he had written nonfiction for a long time.
Yeah.
And he has a big background in environmental issues, and some of them are really front and center in this book, but it's not like an environmental treaty disguised as a novel. It's a really good novel with good characters.
That's very good to hear.
Yeah.
Because of course there's nothing more boring than a political manifesto disguised as a novel, or thinly disguised as a novel.
Right.
Well, we will see you on Thursday, the 23rd of May, at Collected Works Bookstore, which is in downtown Santa Fe. It's at 6 p.m. Anne Hillerman is author of the new book, The Tale Teller, fifth in the Leaphorn Chi series. Thank you.
You have to put Manuelito in there.
Fifth in the Leaphorn Chi and Manuelito series. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849.
The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.